I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe the fact. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking inside me, running down with life, I'm fighting in a far and out deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You run down on my country, and you're walking on the fighting side of me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on right beside me.
Yeah, when you run down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on Light Resistance Radio. .com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, so much more to talk about today. Has hatred of Jews become normalized? This is by Vivian Berkovici, and she is the former ambassador under Stephen Harper, who was just 110% Israel First or Zionist to Israel. She was our ambassador, a Jew as her ambassador to Israel. So this is mostly about how more and more people, especially on campuses, are critical of Israel. Oh, is that anti-Semitism? And the usual complaint, and of course how it's become normalized. And she focuses at some length about three of these radical new Democratic congresswomen who have been elected. Alexandria Octavio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, she's a Somali, and Rashida Tlaib. These are radical Democrats. The latter two are themselves Muslim and Arab. One of them wears a hijab, etc. And they're critical of Israel. Well, what one might say is that at last, there are voices who are a little, I won't say they're immune, they are being pressured and punished, but a little bit immune, or they have a certain amount of cover, because, first of all, they're colored. So, it's a little more difficult to attack them. I mean, the colored being privileged people. So I'll pick up partway through the column. And she picks up, or she's complaining about particularly the Ilhan Omar. In February, Omar tweeted that support for Israel is in America was, quote, all about the Benjamin's baby, clearly suggesting that the well-worn anti-Semitic trope that Jewish money controls foreign policy prevails in America. Benjamin's is a rap lyric reference to the visage of President Benjamin Franklin on American $100 bills. Anyway, so we have dealt with this before, but it's worthwhile, I think, just revisiting it for a moment. And did you notice that the description that Ilhan Omar used this well-worn anti-Semitic trope? Now, this is straight out of the Zionist attack book. Didn't say well-used anti-Semitic accusation or well. This is what the Oxford English Dictionary says. A significant or recurrent theme. Okay. A figurative or metaphorical use of a word or expression. Both clothes and illness become tropes of new attitudes toward the self. That would be an example. So a metaphorical use of a word. Or a recurrent theme. Well, I think that is one that fits more often. She uses, the example being, she uses the Eucharist as a pictorial trope. So let's say a recurrent theme. But that's a very odd word for it, isn't it? I mean, well, why does it say theme or message or argument? It's almost as though this is, in-group or pseudo-Masonic talk, when Ilhan Omar first made these statements and got into so much trouble. I think it was the ADL put out a statement that this was a standard anti-Semitic trope, and then in the letter to, I guess, Speaker Pelosi. The leadership, I believe, of the Republican caucus made the accusation that this was an anti-Semitic trope. And so I thought, first of all, you're basically just mouthing your marching orders, aren't you? I mean, it isn't even subtle. But why use a word that's so unusual? I would say most people could not accurately tell you what a trope was. Another thing that struck me, and I may be wrong on this, trope, at least to a sensitive linguist, sounds a little bit like the French word tromper, which is to a mistake, and which would also suggest that in this case the congresswoman is wrong. Very odd. And I think it's meant to be. I think the confusion actually is deliberate. That you are invited to be mistaken. You don't quite know what it means, and you assume it is wrong. Well, okay, I don't particularly like these three third worlders, and in an ideal world, none of them would be in the United States. But let's go back over what Congresswoman Ilhan Omar said. She said the support for Israel, especially with the Republicans, was all about the Benjamin's baby. And that's the clearly suggesting the well-worn anti-Semitic trope, that is theme, that Jewish money controls foreign policy in America. And then, as I mentioned before, goes on and explains that the Benjamin is rap music talk for $100 bills. In other words, money controls the American foreign policy in terms of Israel. Well, you remember the episode about that. Oh, terrible, terrible, anti-Semitism. Let's take away the adjective, the descriptors, anti-Semitic. My only question is it true? If it's not true, fine. It's an error. Let's call that. Say, no. Jewish money has nothing to do with American foreign policy. Nothing at all. Jews, they're so cheap, they don't contribute a thing to either political party. But is that true? Well, it's not true. 80% of the money coming into the Democratic Party comes from Jews. Jews overwhelmingly, not entirely, but overwhelmingly back the Democratic Party and have for almost a century. Also, a significant amount of Republican money comes from Jews. So this is when it turns out, when you analyze this, what the congresswoman said was accurate. Well, or why was it called? Why would it be called anti-Semitic if it's true? How can it be anti anything? Many snakes are poisonous. Well, let's say, to be quite accurate, some snakes are poisonous. Is that anti-snake? No, it's true. If I said pussycats are poisonous, that might be anti-cat, or at the very least, it's false. Okay, let's get. You see, what you'll have to do here is to analyze and get away from the easy media labeling, which basically is meant to confuse. Okay. It didn't take long before Omar was at it again, stating in late February that pro-Israel activists, in particular the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, in alliance with Jewish legislators, was advocating for allegiance to a foreign country, namely Israel. This accusation of dual loyalty against Jews is one of the most enduring, the ugliest smear of Jews in public life, that they cannot politically be loyal to America or Canada or whatever, wherever they may reside, because they are Jewish. Okay, this accusation of dual loyalty is the ugliest smear of Jews in public life. Never mind whether it's ugly or not. If it's a smear, it would appear to be that it's false. Well, is it false? Is it false? AIPAC is a Zionist lobby. There's nothing subtle about it. There's nothing hidden about it. It is a militant lobby for a foreign government, for the state of Israel. That's not a secret. That's not a lie. Well, I think the problem is that you're not supposed to notice it. Unless you're a politician and you're going to AIPAC and you wear your mandatory beanie and you join in the pledge of undying support for foreign power. And then the accusation is dual loyalty. That's a vicious lie. But is it a vicious lie, or a lie vicious or otherwise? My only question is, as always, is it true? Is it true? If it's not true, then so be it. It's bad. But if it's true, then what's the problem? Indeed, really, what's the problem? And I think we are profoundly onto something here. Of course it's true. Everybody in Washington knows it's true. If you buck AIPAC, you are in for trouble. Why? Because AIPAC controls huge sums of money, which means donations to politicians of both parties, donations that are important during elections, but are perhaps even more important during primaries. Because one way to get rid of a troublesome congressman, let's say, or senator, is to to have that person challenged in the primary, and at that point, AIPAC would and like-minded Jews would back that person's opponent, and there goes their career. And notice this is very clever, because if you don't read it carefully, you get the impression that what is being said is that it's false. But they never say that. It's just, well, you shouldn't say Jews, or let's say some Jews, or many Jews, would seem to have dual loyalty. Or they are more loyal, perhaps, to a foreign state. And that is the tragic truth about American foreign policy here in the, and it has been the case since the end of the Second World War, or since the foundation of the State of Israel, that it becomes a central point of American foreign of American discussion of foreign policy. How do you stand on Israel? How strong are you for Israel? Now, this is a sad and shocking thing, because it means your loyalty or your support for a foreign state is at least as important or more important than your loyalty to the United States, which is one of the reasons that American foreign policy has been so tragically wrong in the Middle East. And then she goes on to complain and groan some more, but it just gives you a rough idea of the approach of the Jewish lobby, that is the requirement of that people support Israel. And interestingly, if you don't, these things are so difficult to discuss, because if you notice, if you say, that would seem to put the loyalty to another state, have loyalty to the, you're anti-Semitic. here's another interesting instance of minority-itis, but in this case, it's not so much Jews. It's the transgendered, once again, jackbooting their way through Canadian politics, enjoying their special status, and in this case, beating up on a group that would normally, you would think, be a group that they would tend to favor. That is, it's a group that tries to help women, or battered women. BC, that's British Columbia. British Columbia is a victim of gender politics. Funding loses funding after refusing trans women. Vancouver's Rape Relief and Women's Shelter, Canada's oldest rape crisis center, has been stripped of city funding after refusing to rescind its policy of only serving female-born women. Okay, let's make sure we're clear of the facts here. So the city of Vancouver will no longer fund the Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter. So it's a rape crisis shelter. And it has a long-standing policy of only serving female-born women. Which means, that's right. Your gender is what you were born with. If you have a vagina and breasts, you're a woman. If you have a penis, you're a man. Doesn't matter what you might think you are. I'm saying perfectly sensible. And why would that be? Well, rape is usually, except perhaps in prisons, a matter of a man penetrating a woman, and they call it a women's shelter, so they deal with women. So it would seem very reasonable that they would serve women. In a statement, the organization said that they were the victim of discrimination against women in the name of inclusion, and accused Vancouver City Council of trying to coerce us to change our position. Meanwhile, the measure was cheered by activists who have long singled out Vancouver Rape Relief as a bastion of trans-exclusionary behavior. After the vote, Vancouver City Councilor Christine Boyle posted a tweet to her account accusing the organization of supporting transphobia. Quote, trans women are women, and sex work is work. I can't support organizations who exclude them. Boyle wrote that she's a councilor. The city council has cut off about a $30,000 grant, which will be a blow, but not a fatal one, because the budget for the Women's Rape and Crisis Center is about $1 million. But nonetheless, so this is an elected councilor, trans women. Those are transgender women. So they start off as men, but think they're women. Are women, and sex work is work. I'm not sure what that has to do. That's, of course, the last decade or so, politically correct euphemism for prostitution. Sex trade workers. Gives you the impression, well, it's really just a job, every bit as much as, let's say, a needle trade worker. You know, some people sew for a living, some people spread their legs for a living. No stigma attached. Of course, this here's one of the internal contradictions of radical feminism. Out of one side of their mouths, they say one shouldn't be dismissive of prostitutes or look down upon them because they're just workers. They just happen to work by spreading their legs. Which I would say largely misses the point. But on the other hand, according to feminism, or some branches of feminism, almost all male interaction with women is wrong. So you can't win. But one of the figures leading the defunding charge against Vancouver Rape Relief was Morgan Auger, a long-standing transgendered advocate and the vice president of the BC NDP. In comments before a March 13th city committee meeting, Auger called Vancouver Rape Relief non-compliant with Canadian law and guilty of systematic, consistent misbehavior. Morgan is a he, Ronan Auger. And we tangled with this sucker on behalf of Bill Watcott at a British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal. Bill, of course, had put out leaflets in the 2017 provincial election against Ronan Auger, who was then running for the NDP in the Vancouver Falls Creek riding. And when Auger lost an election, probably considering the trends, he should have won. He was very, very, very miffed and took poor Bill Watcott to the Human Rights Tribunal for allegedly wounding his dignity. Now, of course, as I've said in commenting on this before, when a person born as a male takes hormone treatments to, I suppose, create something that might look like breasts, wears a relatively low-cut dress that accentuates or at least reveals that there's a cleavage there, wears hoop earrings, bright lipstick, a female hairdo, a dress, I think I mentioned a dress, and high heel shoes, I don't think there's anything Pastor Watcott could say that's going to damage this creature's dignity, you know. The dress-up, I think, says it all. But anyway, he's the middle, he's nasty. I mean, this is a rape and women's shelter that he wants hurt, denied city funding, because they will not accept trans women as women. And they also probably do not believe that the earth is flat. and so therefore they must be punished. The story continues, and I'm not sure if I have the continuation. I should have. yes. The group city funding will dry up at the end of this year. The city of Vancouver contributes $33,000 and change to a budget that's over $1 million. Founded in 1974, Vancouver Rape Relief has long attracted fierce criticism for refusing to admit trans women into its core services, such as peer counseling sessions or its shelters or transition centers. Let's see. This argument gets really nasty. In the official opening of the Vancouver Women's Library, a space with links to the Vancouver Rape Relief Center, it was hijacked by protesters who handed out pamphlets reading, "This library is run by women who hate other women." When the licorice parlor, an East Vancouver candy store, put up a poster in support of a Vancouver Rape Relief Center fundraiser in May, the shop was hit with online harassment and negative reviews for being oppressive and transphobic. Vancouver Rape Relief has said that while they believe trans women need support and protection, their quote lived experience is fundamentally different from a female born woman. And they also go on to point out that discriminatory services are common. In denying service to trans women, the group said that was no different than other city-supported organizations who reserve their services toward a particular demographic group, for instance, immigrants or Chinese speakers or Native youth. Because we are an oppressed group who fights for equality, we have a right to decide who our membership is and who we'll serve, they go on to say. Everybody's an oppressed group. I'm not sure that women who are being raped are an oppressed group. They are, I think, a wrong group and deserve support to deal with their situation. But it's interesting to see the catfight that's occurred here as. Normally, politically correct groups or privileged groups will fall out with each other, and in this case, the trans gang prevailed. So we're going to show them if they won't let a transgendered woman into the rape crisis center, then we're going to cut off their funding. We're going to ruin them, and that is, of course, very typical of political correctness. We will ruin or we will ruin. And while the loss of the city funding is not going to shut the crisis of the center down, it certainly is a blow. And it shows the viciousness of the transgender movement and the utter illogic. They want to impose a fanciful reality on society. And that reality is that the man who thinks he's a woman, because he may or may not have undergone some surgery, it may only be in his head. Just because he thinks that's what he is, then the rest of the world has to go along with that delusion. One of the most perceptive commentators on the American political scene these days is John Craig Roberts, and he was an official in the, I believe he was an official in the Reagan administration. He's quite old, but quite perceptive of the American political scene. And his most recent article is quite to the point. The difficulty of writing for Americans. Writing for Americans, unless for their entertainment, is a challenging undertaking. One reason is that many, especially of the younger generations, no longer have a concept of objective truth. So no longer a concept of objective truth. So truth is, kind of floating. For them, truth is simply a bias reflecting one's race, gender, upbringing, or predisposition. Emotion overwhelms fact. Biases are not considered to be equal. Some are worthy and some are not. The biases of white people are defined as hate speech, or white supremacy, or hate crimes. Today, America has many self-hating whites, especially in the media and the Democratic Party. Another reason is that many Americans confuse an explanation with a justification. An explanation of an event is seen as a justification for the event. For example, if one provides an explanation of slavery, the assumption is that the writer approves of slavery. A defense of a disapproved category is taken as a demonstration of your own unworthiness. For example, if you defend white people from the propagandistic accusations leveled at them by identity politics, you are a white supremacist. As, for instance, if you say that slavery in the United States was not an unending series of lashings and mutilations and so on, then you defend, you're in favor of slavery. No, I'm not particularly, but I am in favor of the truth. And I think John Craig Roberts is very astute in what he sees as happening in America today, and the illogic, and it is illogic of many Americans. He puts it, he says, of the younger generation. I'm not so sure that's just confined to. I don't know what he means. But it'll be under 30s or under 40s or what. But there is a startling lack of logic. And it's on a discriminatory basis. If you defend white people as people, if you say, well, the history of America is not an unending one of exploiting racial minorities. That's all that ever happened. Well, then you must be some sort of a racist. Anyway, back to John Craig Roberts. Yet another reason is that some races and genders have succeeded in defining any criticism of themselves as an expression of bias. For example, criticism of Israel's mistreatment of the Palestinians or of the Israeli lobby's power makes one, you got it, an anti-Semite. Similarly, if you criticize a black person, you are racist, and your argument is dismissed as an expression of your bias. If you criticize a woman, you are a misogynist, and your criticism of a woman proves it. If you express skepticism of false flag events, you are dismissed as a conspiracy theorist. Another reason is that American patriots regard criticism of U.S. policies, especially wars, as anti-American, and as taking the side of the enemy against one's own country. To prevent a recurrence of the Vietnam War protests, when Washington invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, the Bush regime came up with the slogan, "Support our troops." If you criticize the wars, you weren't supporting the troops and were aligning yourself with the enemy. Well, of course, I didn't support either of those wars. Well, I should say any of them, because there are actually two. There's the first Iraq war with Bush the first, and then the second Iraq war in 2003, which is actually more or less still going on, which with Bush the second. if you criticize the wars, you weren't supporting the troops and were aligning yourself with the enemy. You are with us or against us. When President Trump met with President Putin, CIA Director John Brennan accused Trump of treason. When U.S. Representative Tulsi Gabbard met with the President of Syria, of Syria, she was accused of supporting a dictatorship. If her critics had accused her of meeting with Assad because she was a bimbo who didn't know any better, her critics would be dismissed as misogynists. In a world such as this, honest ordinary language is risky, as many are not attending to the cogency of the analysis, but looking for indications of racism or sexism. Exposure of government deceptions gets one branded anti-American, with the result that people cling more tightly to the lie that deceives them. And, you know, Roberts is throwing strikes. It makes a lot of sense. It has always been the case that readers look for writers who reinforce their beliefs by telling them what they want to hear. The king kills the messenger who brings unwanted news. Consequently, there are few messengers. The result is a dysfunctional democracy in which the agendas of those who control explanations dominate. For the most part, readers of this website are different. They are a self-selected group who are motivated to escape from being controlled by official explanations. To their purpose, I lend my knowledge and experience. This website has a devoted readership as your response to my March quarterly appeal. reveals. Anyway, that's pretty much some in-house shop talk. A few of you are impatient for solutions, but there can be no solutions until there's recognition of the problems. Moreover, every solution can be interpreted as favoring some interest group, with its advocate being dismissed as a servant of that favorite group. For example, President Reagan's solution to stagflation was accused of being a scheme for the rich. The people have to find solutions, but first they must be informed. As this article makes clear, that's a difficult enough undertaking. I think it makes a very powerful point of the degree to which many Americans are being propagandized into the inability to think. And here is a good example, only it's not about Americans, it's about Canadians. And here's a handsome-looking white guy, tallish from the picture I see of him on campus. That's at York University in Toronto. And he has a kind of a long, sharp nose. I'd say a handsome-looking white guy. And now I'm not quite sure what I've done with this thing. okay, here we are. What's the story here? Headline. Guy wearing MAGA hat disrupts Toronto vigil for mosque attack victims. Those are the now 50 Muslims who were shot or killed, actually, in an attack on two mosques in Christchurch last Thursday in New Zealand. And the MAGA, incidentally, is Make America Great Again hat. So it's a hat from the 2016 election. and it says, at first, I don't know why it is we have suddenly lost part of this. A somber vigil at York University for the victims of last week's deadly New Zealand mosque attack erupted into chaos Monday afternoon when one person showed up wearing a MAGA hat. The red and white Make America Great Again cap has become a widely divisive symbol since the 2016 U.S. presidential election, synonymous with the members of the alt-right movement and other extremist groups who helped carry Donald Trump to victory. Well, actually, it's not nothing of the sort. It's an iconic emblem of that election. That was Donald Trump's slogan, Make America Great Again. And his supporters, in their thousands, wore these red baseball hats with that writing on it, on them. That basically indicates a supporter of Donald Trump. Wearing a MAGA hat anywhere in Canada is risky for those who wish to avoid confrontation, but wearing a MAGA hat to a vigil for victims of an Islamophobic hate crime to kill 49 people, well, many at York University yesterday seemed to feel it was an act of provocation. You mean you could support Donald Trump, but also not, but at the same time, also feel some sympathy for those who were killed in Christchurch? Well, of course you could. Video footage from Monday afternoon's vigil shows a dramatic confrontation between a young man in a MAGA hat and several attendees. At first, the man can be seen on camera arguing with angry vigil attendees who are asking him to leave. "I can stand here if I want," he says in one video, at which point some people really go off, calling the man everything from a disgrace to an obnoxious asshat. I suspect they also probably called him an asshole. Here's somebody tweeting, "I'm disgusted to even be posting this, but I think people should be informed. Today, a student at York University decided to wear a MAGA hat, Make America Great Again hat, and decided to stand at the vigil held by York students to honor those who were murdered due to the horrific terrorist attacks in New Zealand." Yeah, that's true. So what? Another video starts with an attendee telling the man, "These people don't owe you an explanation. You just need to leave." The man is seen smiling and playing with his phone as students grow increasingly irate. "You're wearing a symbol of racism. Get the fuck out. Get out of here right now," shouts another person, at which point several people start chanting, "Get out, get out. These are university students. I mean, God, the legion of the mindless. You're wearing a symbol of racism. Get the fuck out." What's the symbol of racism? Well, hold on. It's a Make America Great Again hat. Wow. That's a symbol of racism. Really, really fragile, isn't it? Footage of the incident has been circulating since Monday night on Instagram, Reddit, and Twitter, prompting outrage among many of those who've seen it, and sympathy from some others. Anyone who wears a, or actually says that wears, but that's illiterate, wears a MAGA hat in Canada is straight up a dumbass, reads the top voted comment in a Reddit thread about the man's act. So just because you wear a Make America Great Again hat makes you a dumbass. What about all these people who wear Che Guevara t-shirts? Oh, well. Ignoring the ethics stuff, the infatuation some people have in this country with an American leader that harms Canadian industry and trade is mind-boggling, the comment continues. Anyone that is a Canadian Trump supporter is a straight-up moron, more moronic than his voter base in the U.S., where at least his intentions are America first, writes another one. So this is the level of thinking it goes on. The shooting in New Zealand. It's so shitty and disrespectful. Like, how can you disrespect 49 dead people because your political views are different than the majority? Commented one person in a different Reddit thread. The vigil was no place for anyone to preach their political views in the first place. It was a group of people remembering those who died in a racially motivated massacre. In my opinion, it's not a political issue. It's a moral one, wrote another person. Certainly on campus, as John Craig Roberts pointed out, thinking is a thinking is a rarity. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take my musical break right now and start off with a song by Heather Miles, an old Leroy Van Dyke tune.
Just walk on by, wait on. on the corner. I love you, buddy, strangers, when we meet. Just walk on by, wait on the corner. In a dimly lit bar, on the outskirts of town, tonight we'll try to say goodbye again. But I know it's not over, you'll call tomorrow night. We can't stop, so why should we pretend? Just walk on by, wait on the corner. I love you, but we're strangers when we meet. Just walk on by, wait on the corner.
Thank you.
Heather Miles and an old Ray Price tune, Crazy Arms. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Here's another great country and western oldie. It's a duet with Gene Shepherd and Ferlin Husky, Dear John, the Dear John letter.
But I said to her daddy, bless his heart, he was a fine old man, and I said, you know, I've been thinking about Gene, you know, maybe, I said, would you care if we got married? And he said, now that's what me and Mom was talking about. I said, we was afraid this would happen. I said, well, is it because you're afraid that we may have children and leave them with you, or you know, and be on the road all the time and everything? He said, no. He said, well, that too, but he said, the main thing is, he said, we got to think it over, and he said, by her being a shepherd and you being a husky, he said, we couldn't figure out what kind of kids it
you can only follow that with a song. Do the Forgive Me, John.
Dear John, oh how I hate to write. Dear John, I must let you know tonight that my love for you has died away like grass upon the lawn. And tonight I'll wed another.
I was overseas in battle when the postman came to me, and he handed me a letter. I was as happy as I could be, for the fighting was all over and the battle had just been won. Then I opened up the letter, and it started, Dear John.
Dear John, oh how I hate to write. Dear John, I must let you know tonight that my love for you has gone away.
Will you please send back my picture? My husband wants it now. When I tell you who I'm marrying, you won't care, dear, anyhow. Now the ceremony has started. And tonight I'll wed your brother.
That's Ferlin Husky and Gene Shepherd. Of course, they're married. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. If you want to make a suggestion or have some feedback to send my way, my email is paul@paulfromm.com. That's paul@paulfromm.com. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me, and I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe, the dauntless hero, came and planted firm Britannia. shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf.